I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Ari Emanuel is today one of the most important figures in the entertainment industry. In the mid-1990s, he started Endeavor and built it into being a leading talent agency firm, representing, among others, Martin Scorsese. Today, he's built Endeavor into being one of the leading entertainment and sports conglomerates in the world. I sat down with Ari in his offices in New York to discuss the entertainment industry and his firm's future in it.
So you were a talent agent for much of your professional career, but now you're running a multinational, multi-billion dollar sports entertainment conglomerate. So what's it like running a multinational sports company that's public as opposed to being a talent agent?
For me, it really feels natural right now. It's definitely different because it's bigger. It's everything I've ever dreamed of. I still do a lot of work with clients on the talent side, whether it be writer, director, actors, et cetera. But then there's the portion of my life where you're dealing with investors, you're dealing with how to grow the business, where you want to go. A great training ground has been the talent agency business, because you have to build a business for your clients, you have to make sure that they're happy, and now I'm doing all that, plus doing stuff for the company, but also making sure that the shareholders are happy.
So you have to deal with quarterly earnings now, and yes, that's a bit of a pain, sometimes people would say.
I don't really find it a pain. I don't know why. And I guess John Donahoe from Nike said to me one time, well, when the earnings are good, it's an easy process, and they've been good for 5 quarters now. So right now, I feel good about the process. So we'll see. Maybe I'm feeling good where we sit and where the future looks, but I haven't experienced the downside of that conversation.
Talk about the future of the entertainment business. Where do you think it's going? You think there's going to be movie theaters forever, where everything will be streamed at some point? Mm-hmm. And as somebody who represents talent, what are you telling talent about where they should be putting their efforts?
When we started the agency, March 29th, 1995, you know what everybody said? There's going to be no more dramas and no more television. So here's what I would say to you. Distribution is going to change and going to expand. There's going to be new technologies that come into our business. When the movie begins to happen, then DVDs, I mean, it just keeps on expanding. Now you have digital, you have influencers, et cetera. The theatrical business is as important as it's ever been. Is it going to be a $9.3 billion business? No, maybe it'd be an $8 billion business. I'm not sure. But it's not going away. And anybody that says to you, and I won't name names, that says the movie business is over, are fools. The movie business is not over. The television business is not over. We have new verticals, which is content on gambling, social content. It is just an expanding world. And so I think as everybody's now on the demand side of the business, fighting over distribution and content, I've made a decision, and we've made a decision as a company, to be on the supply side. And there's very few suppliers. And in the end, the brands we own, whether it be the UFC, bull riding now, Barrett Jackson, and all the other frees, or the clients we represent that are, we're helping them become brands and companies, are going to be more valuable in the future than less valuable. Because as distribution expands and you have the supply side of that equation and there's very few suppliers, economics improve.
So during COVID, the production of TV shows and movies kind of went down to almost nothing. So what did a firm like yours do because you didn't have a lot of representation you could do?
Well, in the first 3 or 4 months, like most firms, cut costs, cut people, put people, you know, on hiatus. It was a horrible time because I'd never gone through this, and I don't think anybody has gone through this. But the funny thing is, you know, by the end, we had started working through it on the representation side and the event side. We did about 70-75% of our economics, even during COVID. We figured it out by the end. On PBR at the time in UFC, PBR was actually the first sport back. And the head of it, Sean, kind of figured that out, how to do it with testing, et cetera. And then Dana was very quickly right behind that. And Dana calls me up. He said, get me an island. I said, what? He said, get me an island. I'm going to put on fights. And he was like, we're going. Nobody's getting laid off. He's an incredible executive. And I said, okay. You know, I didn't know what to do. And then, as you know, because I've seen you in Abu Dhabi, Khaldun called me. And he said, because there was rumors about this. And he says, why don't you come here? We'll give you an island and we'll figure out economics. And I called up Dana and I said, here's the situation, here's the economics. He goes, we're going. And we set up in Abu Dhabi. I mean, it's famous now. I mean, it kind of, I think, really catapulted the sport in this horrible time. We set up Fight Island. And that whole engine that Dana runs and Dana's force of nature, you know, we put the sport up on its feet, and we flew everybody out, tested them, and we put the fights on. It was.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor Data Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Crazy.
Now, you are one of three very famous brothers. Your oldest...
Yeah, or infamous.
Or infamous. Your oldest brother, Zeke Emanuel, is a very well-known bioethicist and medical doctor and on TV a lot for his views on healthcare. Rahm Emanuel is now our ambassador to Japan, previously was chief of staff to President Obama and also mayor of Chicago. And you are the youngest of the three brothers, is that right?
Or as my father used to say, God rest his soul, the pisher.
That's Yiddish for small.
Yes.
Right? So what is it that your parents did that produced these three very talented children who are in different areas of life but all have done quite well?
Well, first of all, I would say when we were growing up, one of the things I try to do with my kids, and I have four children, is they let us figure stuff out. They didn't program us every hour what we were doing. You had to fend for yourself, you had to figure things out. And the other thing that my parents did is education was crucial. And if you didn't perform, then there was punishment. Meaning you'd be grounded, you know, and there was competition of who got the better grades between the kids. And so with those two things, and you know, my father was a workaholic, he was a pediatrician. And you kind of went around with him when he went on rounds. And on my mother's side, you know, she was a woman that went against the grain in the suburbs of Chicago was very prominent in civil rights, which for that period of time was, you know, nobody could believe that in Chicago and the suburbs. So you saw two people that were willing to go out and be themselves, let us be ourselves, and then gave us some pretty good guardrails.
Now, you've achieved what you've achieved despite two problems that some people would say might make it difficult. One is when you were growing up, you were dyslexic, and I guess you still have some dyslexia.
Yes.
And you had attention deficit disorder, which some people have as well. Maybe,
and some people say, I definitely have not gotten over that.
Right. So, okay, those are things that may sometimes go together, dyslexia and attention deficit disorder. How did you overcome those, and are they still challenges for you?
When I was growing up, I had, you know, my mother, and she made sure that I was going to graduate high school, I was going to go to college, and I was going to learn how to read. And the good thing about it is, I think it's a superpower now. Back then, I hated it. I mean, I remember crying every day when I had to go to the reading teacher for 3 hours and sit in that, like, front window, and it was horrible with my ADHD. And but now, because of the diversity of my business, the ADHD enables me to kind of move around and focus a lot on specific businesses. And the dyslexia, for whatever reason, and I think many people have different points of view on dyslexia, it does enable me to kind of think in a different way. One of the things that happens when you're dyslexic also, you utilize a lot of people around you to help you learn. And in business, that has translated to making sure that you trust a lot of people. I'm not afraid of risk because I was made, you know, kind of, I went through a lot of tough times reading and embarrassment. So nothing now kind of shakes me up. And then when you're running a company, if you empower a lot of people to help you get to the end goal, which is what you have to do when you're dyslexic, you're more successful. So, I mean, those are now attributes and powerful things in my life. Before, they were very difficult.
How did you happen to go to McAllister College, a very good school, but not as well known as some other schools?
Right. You know, I applied to Amherst, which my brother Zeke went to. I didn't get in. I got deferred from Bowdoin. McAllister accepted me.
But later, after you graduated, you became a professional racquetball player for a while?
I played racquetball for about a year and a half, yeah.
Is that an easy way to make money?
No. I was going to go to business school, try to get to Northwestern. And I realized, you know, I don't really want to do that. And I turned to my father, who had gone to school in Europe, and he said, this is what's so great about my father when he was alive. He said, here's a credit card, here's some cash, no plan. 2 days later, I was in Paris. He called me up about 8 months later to a year later, I don't actually remember, and he said, it's time to come home. And I came home, packed up my car in Minnesota, moved to New York, and a friend of mine at the time was working in the mailroom of William Morris, and he explained to me what William Morris was. Because I didn't know that there was agents or what that meant.
William Morris being a major talent agency.
Well, the one we also bought, kind of funny. And then I went to work in New York and got a job working for this gentleman, an older, kind of well-established agent by the name of Robbie Lance. And finally he turned to me, and he was such a wonderful man, Robbie Lance. And he said to me, you know, I'm 84, I'm not going to promote anybody. You should go to Los Angeles. You'll make a lot of money and you'll be an agent there because I'm not going to promote anybody. And so he got me an interview at CAA, and Ray Kurtzman said to me, which he can't say now, he goes, you're too old to go into the mailroom. So I did what I normally do. I peppered him with calls. I mean, I think I called him like 3 times a day, every day for 2 weeks. And he turned to me at the time, and he was another great man. And he said, on a Thursday, and he said, if you can be out here on Monday, you have a job in the mailroom. I got out there. I bought a Le Car, used car for $1,500 or something. And I was in the mailroom, and everybody was younger, and I was off to the races.
Well, explain this to me. Very often I've read that people work in the mailroom. I think David Geffen started the mailroom.
Yes.
Barry Diller started the mailroom. What actually happens in a mailroom at one of these talent agency firms that enables you to rise up?
You would make copies of scripts, and you drive the scripts around to clients or to studio heads. And, you know, you'd deliver paperwork everywhere. You'd get lunches. And then you'd become an assistant. And then you'd become an agent if you were good enough. And that process of, you know, learning the town and et cetera.
To be an agent, you have to have clients, I assume.
Yes.
So to get clients, do you have to go to lunches and dinners? Or how do you get clients when you don't have any clients?
Well, I was promoted in the television department because I had worked for the head of business affairs and then the head, one of the lead agents there, and also this gentleman by the name of Bill Haber. And I was in the office as their assistant every day for 7 days, you know, Monday through Sunday, doing whatever it took. And they were great teachers, you know, both Bruce Vinegar and Bill Haber. They promoted me. And then you would go out to the studios and go to sets where people were shooting and writers were writing. And I was a writer's television agent. And you would read stuff that came over to Transom and you would try to sign them. And I, even though I'm dyslexic, I read a lot, went to watched a lot of TV shows, saw what I liked, and signed a lot of clients that were quote unquote talented, and I think they are talented and they're still talented, and built my business.
How long before you say, you know what, I should have my own company?
So I had been, by the time I had started Endeavor, I think I had been an agent for about 4.5 to 5 years. And I was looking at the world. I read this book by George Gilder called Life After Television. And it talked about infinite distribution. And that distribution in our business was going to expand with cloud computing, et cetera, et cetera. And I brought him in to speak at ICM, and nobody really understood. And I talked to him after reading the book. And I said, you know, it's going to go from 4 networks to 6. I'm in the television business. The way you make money at the time in television, you put TV packages on the air. I've got a great client list. Why would I put a package on the air where you can make a lot of money for your clients and for yourself and give it to them for what I thought was a okay salary? Again, my father almost had a heart attack because they were offering me a lot of money to stay. My contract was up. And I can, you know, with 3 other gentlemen, we said, you know, I said, I could, with my clients, if we do this, we can make a lot of money because I know what I can put on the air because I've been doing it now for a long time.
Where'd you get the name Endeavor?
So the 4 of us were sitting around trying to think of a name, rocks, rivers, whatever, and one of the partners said, well, we should think about NASA. They have great names. So the first name we thought of was the Discovery, and then we realized it crashed. So that was out. And then he just says, what about Endeavor? Which was, and we all realized that was a great kind of image of what we wanted to create for clients.
Okay.
And so that was
what year did you start Endeavor?
Actually on my birthday, March 29th, 1995.
Okay, so it went very well from the beginning because you had
yes.
clients, but you bought William Morris.
Correct.
Or you merged with them.
Quote unquote.
Merged, but they were twice as big as you and
yeah.
you became the CEO. How did that happen?
About 4 years before that, we went to see another kind of mentor, a person who's been unbelievable in helping my life, Professor Nitin, who became the chairman of Harvard Business School. And we asked him to kind of let's go over, you know, I'd never been to business school, like game theory of what we should do to grow and kind of consolidate the business with the thesis that distribution is going to change the environment. And we laid out over 2 days on a whiteboard that we should go after William Morris and try and merge, buy, whatever.
So you merge the company, you become the sole CEO, and then you start...
I was Patrick Weitzel, my partner, who's still
right.
my partner, and I became the CEOs.
Now you are starting to buy companies.
Yes.
You bought IMG, which
yes.
is a entertainment, is a sports representation business, right?
It's a sports production events company.
All right, you bought that, and then later you bought UFC.
Well, that's where you and I met.
Right, that's right. And you then bought UFC later?
Well, we then bought PBR, we bought Droga 5 prior to that. We then bought the UFC and bought some other stuff.
You bought UFC and you did it with the help of Silver Lake, a well-known private equity firm. And the CEO there help you get this done?
Yeah, I mean, what happened was I was lining up people to go buy IMG. You and I had that conversation.
Right.
And he came in and he said, listen, let me invest in William Morris Endeavor, and then let's go after IMG and kind of create this global platform and go from there. I said to him, private equity is not going to be able to do that. He said, well, give me 3 weeks, show me your numbers, and I'll come back, and if I can make a deal, I can make a deal. And he and I had known each other, actually, through Mark Andreessen. He came up. We made a great deal, great for him, great for us. We then got IMG, and then we realized that that was, everything we had done was incredible, global, unbelievable kind of building blocks, and we realized that was in the representation business, the service business, and that we, if we put something that we owned on top of it, that we could get the full leverage of the platform and own something. And I had represented the UFC for a number of years, knew Dana, knew Frank and Lorenzo, and then they were going to sell it. And then we had proven also to Egon that we could buy a business and own it and operate it with professional bull riding. And then it was us against some Chinese investors at the time. We secured the rights, and here we are.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio. Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
For many people, you're a role model, and many people would like to have your lifestyle and your life. What would you like to have as your legacy? 50 years from now, what do you want people to say about Ari Emanuel?
I think legacy is such a fallacy. You've studied presidents. Presidents have a legacy. I think maybe sports stars have a legacy. Some actors have a legacy. Very rarely do business people, maybe inventors that are business people. Steve Jobs will probably have one. Elon Musk will have one. Einstein will have one. But business people, I'm not, this notion of a legacy, and I have gotten in trouble about this, is a complete and utter wanting to live forever fallacy that exists in business minds.
Suppose somebody is watching and says, I want to be Ari Emanuel when I grow up. What should somebody do to get into the talent agency business or the business you're in, which is representing people, building companies in the sports and entertainment world?
Well, it's hopefully what I've taught my kids. You got to be intellectually curious. You got to be, you got to show up. And you know this like I know this. I got on a lot of planes. Even though that voice in your head is saying, oh God, I'm so tired, I don't want to do this. You got to show up. You got to be charmingly relentless. You have to build emotional endurance, because there's no straight line of success. It's kind of all over the place, and you have to just be able to work through those things. And then I think one of the things that I do every week is I try to create serendipity.
So Ari Emanuel is a well-known person in the entertainment world, but there was another figure named Ari Gold.
Yeah.
Who was a fictional character that many people thought was named after you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like that? Did you not like that? And what is it like when you're more famous than your clients?
Well, here's what I would say. At the time of the show, and Mark Wahlberg is a client of mine, and I helped put that show together, I didn't like it at the beginning because it depicted me. There were some things that were for sure not true, and then there were some things that I hated seeing that were true. I'm not that same person anymore. But later on, especially after COVID, a lot of people kept on seeing it. It's for sure opened a lot of doors. And at the time, at the end, my brother was in the White House. The show was on the air. I mean, I got a lot of, you know, people would pick up my phone call.
Is there anybody today that won't return your phone calls? I assume there's nobody in the world.
I get a lot of people on the phone when I need to.
So in the entertainment world today, you're pretty much at the top of the totem pole. You know everybody. You have one of the best companies under you. You're the CEO of it. How many more years would you like to do this?
Well, here's what I'd say to you is, if I'm not happy, if I'm not still intellectually stimulated, if I'm not feeling like I get up every morning, and I get up bright and early every morning, want to do what I do every day and kind of do it, and I'm bored of it, I will not be doing it.
But today, you're pretty happy and you're not bored.
Today, I'm really happy. I've built everything that I want to build. There's more things I want to do, and there's more dreams I have.
You're famous for being a fitness expert, or I guess...
This is the men's health version of this interview?
Yes.
Okay, I can learn.
I can learn something. So when did you decide to become so fit? And were you always this way?
I've always been this way.
You get up and then you go right to the gym?
I have a certain beginning routine of, as you know, vitamins and certain things I do in the morning. I go to the gym. It's about an hour and 45 minutes to 2 hours. In my house, I have a sauna and I have an ice bath. I then do a sauna and I meditate.
But what about eating? I mean, you eat, you're very careful what you, you're not eating a lot of hot dogs, I assume.
I'm a vegan. Actually, I've tweaked that a little bit because I do, after being 61, I do eat a little bit of meat now. Once a quarter, I do an extended fast, which is probably anywhere from 60 to 72 hours. And then every week I do a daily fast, and then I eat in a 6 to 4 hour window every other day.
And has anybody told you this is a little unusual to do this?
Well, you could imagine there's other craziness inside this, which I will not go into.
You can
imagine the conversations. So about 5 years ago, my brother Zeke, who's famous for saying that he wants to die at 75, said, "You'll live an hour longer." I said, "If I live an hour longer, then you never know what's gonna happen in that hour. It's not about living. It's only about being healthy, both emotionally and physically, for as long as you live."
Thanks for listening. To hear more of my interviews, you can subscribe and download my podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/FutureInvestor/radio.